From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Across the United States, an estimated 80,000 to 100,000 prison inmates are kept in solitary confinement, locked up for at least 22 hours a day in tiny cells. The practice is considered barbaric and tantamount to torture. Yet prisons in the U.S. continue to isolate inmates, sometimes for years or even decades. The impact of solitary confinement on the human brain has been found to be severely detrimental. Humans are not meant to be isolated from one another. Solitary confinement costs more than keeping prisoners in the general population, and it has been found to not reduce overall violence. So why do we keep doing it? Joining me to help answer that question is Terry Allen Cooper, a professor emeritus at the Wright Institute, an award-winning psychiatrist and author of Prison Madness. He now joins me to discuss his new book, Solitary, the inside story of supermax isolation and how we can abolish it. Welcome to the program, Dr. Cooper.
Thank you. Good morning, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about the impact on the human brain. We, as I mentioned, human beings are not meant to remain in isolation for so many hours a day and so many years at a time. There have been times that elected officials have tried to take on the issue by putting themselves through the process and found it to be terribly isolating and really tantamount to torture. So as a psychiatrist, what does it do to the human brain?
Well, it's interesting that you ask about the brain, because everything I say that happens psychologically has parallels in brain structure. It very much damages brain structure and lays down pathways which cause dysfunction. Everyone, pretty stable people, if they're put in a cell by themselves, gets very anxious. Their thinking gets distorted. They become paranoid in many cases. They pace. They clean their cells over and over. They despair of ever getting out, and the suicide rate is very high. That's people who are fairly stable. Now, if someone has a pre-existing mental illness, especially a serious mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or severe depression, the isolation exacerbates their mental illness, makes their prognosis much worse, makes their disability greater, and in the end, they get out of prison unable to function in the community.
What is the justification given for solitary confinement? And we should make sure and address the fact that it's not really called solitary confinement everywhere. So it's just, different prisons use different terms for it, restriction, et cetera. So is there an agreed upon definition, and how do prisons justify using it?
Well, the people who advocated, and they're becoming fewer and fewer, quite a few directors of departments of corrections agree with me that solitary confinement is overused and damaging. But the ones who like it say that it quells violence, which of course is entirely wrong. In the 80s, the prisons were totally out of control. There was unrestrained violence, and the authorities did not know what to do. I and other experts recommended downsizing the prisons. They were massively overcrowding. Crowding correlates with higher violence and mental breakdown. And to upgrade the rehabilitation services. They did not listen to us. Instead, they turned to isolating who they called the worst of the worst. Now, there's 100,000 people in solitary confinement in our prisons today, so they're not the worst of the worst. And what they say is that it decreases violence on the yard and helps them control gangs. That's absolutely untrue, and there's no valid research that shows that solitary confinement improves violence or gang activity. I think they do it as a PR effort. That is, by putting people in very small cages and keeping them there nearly 24 hours a day, they're advertising that these are heinous criminals, and therefore the public should increase the corrections budget and lock these people up and throw away the key. I believe that's the real reason for it. But in any case, the experiment has failed, and it is just destroying a lot of lives.
I imagine it's also a way to punish prisoners, personal vendettas and frustrated staff or guards that work there. might be using it to, you know, in a place that's kept so invisible from the rest of American society to punish prisoners.
That's correct. I think that what's happened is we've disappeared into the prisons, exactly the people that we don't, as a society, spend the resources to help. For instance, people with serious mental illness. Another factor is race. Our prison population is 40 or 50% African American, way out of proportion with the population at large. And the prison population sort of reflects the racism of our greater society. And sure enough, the people in solitary confinement are disproportionately people of color.
Now, isn't torture supposed to be unconstitutional? Shouldn't this practice have been done away with, just banned in the United States, a country that considers itself, you know, some sort of beacon of freedom and human rights the world over?
That's absolutely correct. Solitary confinement is a human rights abuse. It has been called torture by the Special Rapporteur on Torture of the United Nations. And in the United States, people say that we're a democratic and humane society and we don't torture people, but yet torture is going on. It is definitely a violation of the Constitution. In a recent case in California, the Ashker v. Brown case, we finally got a ruling from a court that it is an unconstitutional setting in the prison. Previously, we had had special populations, for instance, those with serious mental illness or juveniles, who should be excluded from solitary confinement. The courts that have upheld that position. But now we have a position that actual conditions in solitary confinement are unconstitutional, and in the international community, that's equivalent to torture.
How many prisoners have you had the chance to talk to and interview? Can you give us a sense of the research you did in putting your book Solitary together? Because, you know, most of American society is cut off from prisoners while they're going through solitary confinement. Those who are family members in prisons may never truly get the full picture from, you know, their loved ones. And of course, they are not necessarily qualified psychiatrists. So give us a sense of the amount of research and the type of research you did to arrive at your conclusions.
Well, I have been serving as an expert witness in large class action lawsuits and involving jails and prisons for 40 years. And over that time, I've interviewed at least 1,000 prisoners in jail and prison. And I would say over half of those are in solitary confinement. So I've done a significant amount of research. You are absolutely right that as a general rule, more abusive practices require more secrecy. So when the public thinks we're locking people up and throwing away the key, actually what they're doing is turning them over to correction officers who have absolutely no public overview of what they're doing, and they abuse prisoners terribly. For instance, cell extractions, where they go in and remove them from the cell, usually after spraying them with pepper spray and beating them up. And the public knows little about this.
In your book, Solitary, the inside story of supermax isolation and how we can abolish it, you describe a prisoner, and you haven't, of course, used their real names to protect their privacy, but you call him Gene, and you say you met one of the most severely disturbed individuals that you'd ever encountered in the entire course of your career. Tell us Gene's story, because, of course, it's so important for us to humanize. These are human beings.
Absolutely. And that's one of the main things I do as an expert witness and in public presentations. The people in prison are human beings. They're an average population just like out in the community. I meet prisoners who are very intelligent, who are very kind. There are a variety of people in our prisons. Gene is someone with schizophrenia. He's suffering from the mental illness schizophrenia. Prior to going to prison, he was in several hospitals and was prescribed antipsychotic medications, which had a good effect. He went to prison, and somewhere along the line in prison, the doctors decided that he was malingering, meaning they thought he was faking his symptoms. He hallucinates, he has paranoid ideas that he obsesses about, he smears feces, he cuts himself, And he makes a lot of commotion in the prison. So they moved him to a supermax solitary confinement unit. Many of the lawsuits, for instance, Madrid v. Gomez in California, prohibit putting people with serious mental illness in solitary confinement. But in Gene's case, they decided that he was malingering, so he did not have a diagnosis, and he was left to just survive as best he could in a solitary cell, and that's how he started harming himself, cutting himself, smearing feces, and making a racket. And they just kept him locked up in a solitary cell. The more racket he made, the further back they moved him from where the guards sit, and he was just having a horrible existence.
And so going back to what you said earlier about people who have pre-existing mental conditions or illnesses, you know, exacerbates it more. And then people who do go in without mental issues emerge with them having been through solitary. Your book subtitles suggest you want to abolish solitary altogether. What do you say to those who say, well, you know, we need to reform it. We can use it in, you know, sparingly. We can improve conditions, maybe make the cells a little bit bigger, not use it for as many hours a day. How do you respond?
Well, in New York, they're doing an experiment with that at Attica, the state prison in New York, where the rebellion happened in the 70s. And they have a residential mental health unit. Disability advocates in New York just published a report exposing the fact that they are basically keeping the people suffering from serious mental illness in their cell almost 24 hours a day. And many of the cells are covered with a Lexan shield. Lexan is indestructible fiberglass. And they put the shield over the door so that the prisoner, for instance, can't throw things at staff. But what it does is it raises the temperature and the humidity in the cell and further isolates the prisoner. So this is a dedicated unit for mental health treatment. Inevitably, such units deteriorate. And that's the problem. So it is possible to do, well, you know, we've transferred in the last 30, 40 years, we've transferred a huge proportion of people with serious mental illness into the jails and prisons. I advocate releasing them, doing radical sentencing reform, alternatives to incarceration, and putting people with mental illness into a treatment setting where they can thrive. That's not jail or prison. And the recent attempts to create mental health jails and mental health prisons is doomed to failure because inevitably, like at Attica, the conditions deteriorate and then abuses multiply.
Now, haven't there been prisons that have tried abolishing just at least solitary confinement and found much better results? I mean, setting aside the question of prison abolition, are there alternatives to just the use of solitary confinement itself? And can you give us some examples?
Yes. And there has been an attempt. There are many correctional authorities in the United States who have figured out that solitary was a foolhardy direction to take. For instance, Rick Ramish in Colorado, he's the director of the Colorado Department of Corrections. He's reduced the solitary confinement proportion of his prisoners from 8% to 1%. And what he does is he places people who are having trouble conforming their behavior to the prison rules. And the prison rules are extreme. But the people who are having trouble because of mental illness, he's put them in special programs. We put more people in prison, and then a greater proportion of the people we put in prison, we put in solitary, than any other country in the world. So you can look anywhere and find examples.
For instance, not just by sheer numbers, but actual proportion.
Yes.
Per capita. Yeah.
And geometrically, we put more people in prison. The Scandinavian countries, Holland, all have prisons that don't use solitary at all. In fact, they put people in humane conditions, and their recidivism rates and parole violation rates are much, much lower than in the United States. In England, there is Grendon Prison, which is a maximum security prison where people who have committed murder and armed robbery are kept. they use no solitary confinement. They do group therapy in a therapeutic community with the prisoners, and people are able to go through there. The people who are released are able to succeed at going straight in the community, very different than in the United States.
Now, let's also talk about how it is even more expensive also to keep prisoners in solitary confinement and the cheaper options that happen to be more humane and more compassionate also happen to be the ones that work better. So there seems to be, you know, it seems to be a win-win to abolish solitary confinement. Yet we keep doing it. Sometimes the money issue is what works with politicians. Is that true? Should we talk about that it's cheaper to abolish solitary?
That is absolutely true. And a lot of the authorities in corrections who have come out against putting people in solitary have done so because of the financial implications. I think that when we talk about money, we're talking too short range. That is, we're thinking about this quarter's budget. What we really ought to think about is how these individuals who are kept in solitary for years or decades, how dysfunctional they get, and then the future costs to society and to them and their misery, but also the expense of mental health services, future incarceration, their unemployment and unemployability. And that ought to be what we measure into the calculation on cost. But in any case, I will accept the support of people who are against solitary merely because of finances. But really, it's destructive to human beings, and that's the reason we should abolish it.
Does it also seem to you to be a measure of our collective humanity that we keep the practice of solitary in place? I mean, shouldn't the use of this particular method of incarcerating people be seen as reflective of us as a whole?
Absolutely. It was Dostoevsky who said you can tell the quality of a society by going into its prisons. Hmm. Solitary confinement is torture, and it destroys people. So that the main problem, I've talked about people with serious mental illness where their mental illness gets worse, but the main problem is people who never actually exhibit a serious mental illness, but their life is just damaged. They become duller, less active, they have less initiative, less agency than they would have had. And they leave prison and they live a very subdued life and they're not very productive. That's the more widespread damage. And we as a society should not be allowing our state institutions to cause that kind of damage.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Coopers, for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, and my pleasure.
My guest is Dr. Terry Allen Coopers, a professor emeritus at Wright Institute and award-winning psychiatrist and author of Prison Madness. We've been discussing his newest book, Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.